And this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, a study says China's main international building project could face failure as debts grow and other countries cool on the plans. Chinese President Xi Jinping launched the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI, in 2013. He said the aim of the infrastructure project was to build a broad community of shared interests throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America. But Xi's plan faces major financial difficulties and foreign opposition, says a new report by researchers at the College of William and Mary's Aid Data Group in the United States. Brad Parks helped write the report. He says a growing number of policymakers in low- and middle-income countries are mothballing high-profile BRI projects because of overpricing, corruption, and debt sustainability concerns. Mothballing means to stop doing something until possibly sometime in the future. Aid Data said more than $58.5 billion worth of projects in Malaysia have been canceled since the BRI launched. The study found a combined loss of more than $2.5 billion worth of projects in Kazakhstan and Bolivia. China's foreign ministry said in a statement that not all debts are unsustainable. The ministry also argued that the BRI has always honored the ideas of shared knowledge, shared work, and shared results. The ministry added that many partner countries say the BRI has been helpful for local economic development. The Aid Data study looked at 13,427 projects supported by China in 165 countries over 18 years. The projects were worth a total of $843 billion. The researchers also report that China now spends two times the amount of the United States in international development efforts. But Brad Parks says major changes in public feeling about the BRI make it difficult for partner countries to keep close relations with China. Credit risks have risen along with BRI project cancellations. Chinese debt now exceeds 10% of gross domestic product in many low- and middle-income countries. The GDP is the total value of a country's production of goods and services. The study found that corruption, labor violations, pollution, and public protests affect 35% of Belt and Road projects. In June, the United States announced a competing plan known as Build Back Better World, or B3W. The aim of the plan is to provide financial support for developing nations to build infrastructure. B3W is going to increase choice in the infrastructure financing market, which could lead to some high-profile BRI defections, Park said.
The U.S. government has predicted that an important river in the American West will have a water shortage. The Bureau of Reclamation recently declared the first shortage on the Colorado River. The announcement means Arizona, Nevada, and also Mexico will get less water than normal next year. The Colorado River supplies Lake Powell and Lake Mead, which is the largest man-made lake in the U.S. The lakes have been hard hit by drought in the past 30 years. The Colorado River supplies 40 million people with water. Both lakes have decreased to historic lows. The lakes currently have a combined capacity of 39%, down from 49% at this time last year, the Bureau of Reclamation said. The seven U.S. states that depend on the Colorado River agreed to a drought plan in 2019 to help support the lakes by reducing water use. All agree more needs to be done and are discussing what will replace a set of guidelines for the river and the drought plan. Both the guidelines and the drought plan end in 2026. The water level on Lake Mead serves as a measure for how much river water some western U.S. states get, including Arizona, Nevada, and California. By 2025, there is a 66% chance Lake Mead will reach a level where California would face cuts in water for a second time. Lake Powell, on the Arizona-Utah border, is the guide for Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, and Utah. Those states cover an area known as the Upper Basin. Smaller lakes upstream of Lake Powell have been releasing water so Lake Powell can continue producing hydropower. But any increase from the releases is not included into the 5-year estimates, the Bureau of Reclamation said. Wayne Pullen is the Bureau's director for the Upper Basin. In a statement, Pullen described the latest estimates for Lake Powell as troubling. The U.S. federal government has also formed a working group to consider the issue. The Bureau of Reclamation's 5-year estimates are meant to help water officials plan by using the best available information, said Jacqueline Gould. Gould oversees the lower basin for the Bureau of Reclamation. Its August estimates are what decide how much water states can use. The agency says there is a 22% chance that Lake Mead will drop to 304 meters above sea level in 2025. Federal officials have said water would become unavailable to states downstream at 272 meters above sea level. I'm John Russell.
A California company is using robots to grow plants in greenhouses that it says use 90% less water than traditional farms. The company, Iron Ox, operates several greenhouses and has plans to expand. It recently announced a new $50 million investment. The financing was led by Breakthrough Energy Ventures, a company established by Microsoft founder Bill Gates. At a 930-square-meter center in Gilroy, California, Iron Ox uses a self-driving robot named Grover, to transport containers of plants. The large greenhouse uses hydroponics, a system designed to grow plants in materials other than soil, such as water. The company says each container, known as a module, carries 30 liters of water and about 70 seedlings as it moves. Another machine uses robotic arms to lift the top of the plants out of the water. This permits the roots to be inspected. Sensors also examine the water, measuring levels of nitrogen and acidity. Iron Ox claims the system uses 90% less water than traditional farms, as well as 90% less electricity than indoor farms using LED lights. LED stands for light-emitting diode, which produces light up to 90% more efficiently than regular lights. Sarah Osentoski is the company's senior vice president of engineering. She told Reuters news agency she believes robots like these can help prepare for a more sustainable future. "I think it's a really exciting way we can move forward in agriculture right now," Osentoski said. "I really believe that we need to grow in a way that could feed the future of the world without hurting the earth," she added. "So a big part of our mission is to grow more with less." The company notes that in its greenhouses, any water not used can be pumped back into the system to be reused later. Agriculture is an important part of California's economy, but water usage has increasingly become a concern. The last major drought in 2012 to 2017 cut water for farmers, forced household usage limits, and fueled deadly wildfires. Iron Ox currently grows Thai basil and strawberries and is working on cilantro, parsley, and tomatoes. The company plans to build a new 50,000 square meter greenhouse in Lockhart, Texas. There, the robots will be moving about 5,400 modules. Iron Ox CEO Brandon Alexander told Reuters that building the company has been an eye-opener for him and others. "I think we're now at a stage where most people understand that conditions are only getting worse," he said. The system includes another inspection station that uses overhead cameras to capture three-dimensional or 3D images of the plant. Scientists use this data to study crop production levels. "We want to give each plant exactly what it needs and nothing it doesn't," Alexander said. After the sensors examine the plants, the system provides suggestions for what is missing. Sarah Osentoski sees the robotic indoor system expanding in the coming years to become a scalable model. "I think it's a really interesting way to bring modern technology in a controlled setting to agriculture." I'm Brian Lynn. Thank you.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. During the first half of the 19th century, leaders of the United States could find no answer to the question of slavery. The dispute grew more threatening after the war with Mexico in 1849. Northern states refused to permit slavery in the new territories of California and New Mexico. Southern states declared that they had a constitutional right to bring slaves into the new lands. The South was ready to secede, to leave and break up the Union of States. Then, in 1850, Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise to avoid secession and a likely war between the North and South. He said the Union was permanent and created for all future Americans. He attacked the South's claim that it had the right to leave. He warned the war that would follow Southern secession would be long and bloody. 1 week after Senator Clay spoke, Senator Jefferson Davis of Mississippi explained his position. He did not say much about Clay's proposed compromise. Davis was sure that no good would result from it, not even from stronger laws on the return of escaped slaves. Davis said what was needed was a change in the North's policy toward the South. He said the North must recognize the rights of Southerners, especially the right to take slave property into U.S. territories. Davis said Congress had no right to destroy or limit this right. He admitted that the old Missouri Compromise of 1820 had limited the right to take slaves into the territories. He said the 1820 Compromise worked not because Congress passed it, but because the states agreed to it. Senator Davis said the North was responsible for the growing split in the country because the North was trying to get complete control of the South. He said if these efforts were not stopped, the North someday would be powerful enough to change the Constitution and end slavery everywhere. Davis warned the South would never accept this change. 3 weeks later, the Senate heard another Southern leader, Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina. For years, Calhoun was the voice of the South. He now was 68 years old and a sick man. He spent the last week in February writing what he believed to be the true position of the South. Many senators understood it would be his last speech. On Monday, March 4th, the Senate was crowded when Calhoun entered. One by one, friends came to speak to him. The old man's long gray hair fell to his shoulders. His face was thin and white, but his eyes were bright and his jaw firm. Calhoun was too weak to read his speech. He asked another senator to read it for him. Calhoun said that for a long time he had believed the dispute over slavery, if not settled, would end in disunion. Calhoun said it was clear now to everyone that the Union was breaking apart, that the ties that had held the North and South together were breaking one by one. Three churches, once united across the nation, now were split between the North and South. The major political parties, he declared, were divided in the same way. Calhoun said the North was responsible for all this disunity, because it had destroyed the political balance between the two parts of the country. As the population of the North had grown large, he noted, that part of the country seized political and economic control. The North passed tariff bills the South opposed. It had filled most of the offices in the federal government. It closed the new territories to Southern slaveholders. And, said Calhoun, it viciously attacked the Southern institution of slavery. The situation was so bad, he said, that the South could not, with honor and safety, remain in the Union. How can the Union be saved, he asked. Not by the compromise proposed by the senator from Kentucky. There is but one way, a full and final settlement with justice of all the questions disputed by the two sections. The South asks for justice, simple justice, unless she ought not to take. She has no compromise to offer but the Constitution, and no concession or surrender to make. She has already surrendered so much that she has little left to surrender. At the end of Calhoun's speech to the Senate, Southern lawmakers crowded around the old man, congratulating him. But many of them could not agree with his demands and the violence of his words. By now, most Southerners believed that Senator Clay's proposals were a reasonable way to settle the difference and protect the Union. Yet Clay worried that Northerners might reject his proposals. Many in the North felt slavery was wrong. They opposed Clay's compromise because it might permit slavery in New Mexico, and because it called for stronger laws on the return of slaves who had escaped to the North. So Clay asked an important senator from the North to speak in support of his proposals. Daniel Webster represented the northeastern state of Massachusetts. Senator Webster believed that slavery was evil. Yet he believed that national unity was more important. He did not want the nation to divide. He did not want to see the end of the United States of America. Webster was 68 years old, as old as Calhoun. 3 days after Calhoun's speech, Webster spoke to the Senate. His voice was weaker now, but his words rang with the same strength as years earlier. I speak today, he said, to save the Union. I speak today out of a concerned and troubled heart. I speak for the return of a spirit of unity. I speak for the return of that general feeling of agreement which makes the blessings of this Union so special to us all. Senator Webster spoke of how he hated slavery. He spoke of his fight against the spread of slavery, but he disagreed with those who wanted laws making slavery illegal in new territories. It would not be wise to pass such laws, he said. They would only make the South angry. They would only push the South away from the Union. Then Webster spoke about the things the North and South had done to make each other angry. One, he said, was the failure of the North to return runaway slaves. He said the South had good reason to protest. It was a matter of law. The law was contained in Article 4 of the nation's Constitution. Every member of every Northern legislature, Webster said, has sworn to support the Constitution of the United States. And the Constitution says that states must return runaway slaves to their owners. This part of the Constitution has as much power as any other part. It must be obeyed. Next, Webster spoke about abolition societies. These were organizations that demanded an end to slavery everywhere in the country. I do not think that abolition societies are useful, Webster said. At the same time, I believe that thousands of their members are honest and good citizens who feel they must do something for liberty. However, their interference with the South has produced trouble. As an example, Webster spoke about the state of Virginia. Slavery was legal there. Webster noted that public opinion in Virginia had been turning against slavery until abolitionists angered the people. After that, he said, no one would talk openly against slavery. He said abolitionists were not ending slavery, but helping it continue. Then Webster said the North also had a right to protest about some things the South had done. He said the South was wrong to take slaves into new American territories. He said attempts to expand slavery violated earlier agreements to limit slavery to areas where it already existed. Webster said the North also had a right to protest statements by Southern leaders about working conditions in the North. Southerners often said that slaves in the South lived better lives than free workers in the North. Webster appealed to both sides to forgive each other. He urged them to come to an agreement. He said the South could never leave the Union without violence. Webster said the two sides were joined together socially, economically, culturally, and in many other ways. There was no way to divide them. No Congress, he said, could establish a border between the North and South that either side would accept. In general, Webster's speech to the Senate was moderate. He wanted to appeal to reason, not emotion. Yet it was difficult for him to be unemotional. His voice rose as he finished. Secession, he called out. Peaceable secession. Your eyes and mine will never see that happen. There can be no such thing as peaceable secession. We live under a great constitution. Is it to be melted away by secession, as the snows of a mountain are melted away under the sun? Let us not speak of the possibility of secession. Let us not debate an idea so full of horror. Let us not live with the thought of such darkness. Instead, let us come out into the light of day. Let us enjoy the fresh air of liberty and union. Northern abolitionists quickly criticized Daniel Webster's speech. They called him a traitor. But most people of the North accepted Webster's appeal for compromise. His speech cooled the debate that threatened a complete break between the North and South. Yet the speech was not the end of the debate.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.